This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about a new initiative in New York State designed to reduce the number of elderly and sick in prison.
While the number of prisoners in the country has gone down, the number of elderly prisoners has shot up. 15, 20, 30, 40 years, you almost never get out of prison in New York and in many other states throughout the country.
Attorney General Eric Holder recently gave a speech to the American Bar Association promising to reassess the harsh mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug offenders.
It got front page news, but he's already been in office for 5 years. Has anyone been released? Our guest will discuss the limitations of what Holder said.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Here on Law and Disorder, we've talked about the Compassionate Release Program regarding Lynn Stewart's condition. This program is designed to reduce the number of elderly and sick in prison if they have a terminal health condition or a significant and permanent non-terminal health condition, disease, or syndrome. This program is part of a larger effort to release aging inmates in the United States. Nationally, the number of prisoners over age 55 nearly quadrupled from 1995 to 2010. This is 8 times the pace of growth for the total prison population, according to a recent Human Rights Watch report. Because of long sentences handed out in the 1970s and 80s, American correctional facilities now serve as quasi-nursing homes, albeit lacking the long-term care we associate with geriatric facilities. To talk about this, we're joined today by Laura Whitehorn and Mujahid Farid, both former prisoners. Laura and Mujahid, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
On this show, we've talked a lot about the issue of mass incarceration, but could you frame for us the issue of those who are aging in prison and what problems this presents?
Clearly, most people are aware of the issue of mass incarceration. It's something that's being discussed and debated throughout the country now. It's become a big issue. But I'm wondering if people are really aware that the issue of mass incarceration has many facets. In fact, in some communities, it impacts on those communities from the cradle to the grave. And one of the issues within mass incarceration that we identified as being manifest injustice is how the age is treated within that particular problem. America has, as most of us know, more people incarcerated per rater than any other country in the world. But they have taken note of it recently, and what a lot of people have not probably been updated on is that the population has somewhat stabilized. The prison population is somewhat stabilized. It's still at a rate that beats out every other country. It's a rate that's unacceptable. But although that rate has stabilized, it hasn't done so with the elderly. In fact, in New York State, in the last 10 years, the prison population has gone down 24% in the last 10 years. And during that same 10-year period, the population of the elderly actually increased by 64%.
How many people are we talking about here in New York State and America generally?
You want to answer that?
In New York State, there are 9,000 and change people over the age of 50, 9,200, something like that, right, at the moment. That number has increased every year.
And what about across the country?
And across the country, I'm not sure right now, but by 2030, it's estimated that a third of the entire incarcerated population will be over the age of 40, and there will be at least 400,000. And that the rate of incarceration of older people, people over 50, will have increased since the 80s to 2030 by 4,400%.
Now, that's not because older people are committing more crimes, I assume. It's because they're spending a lot of more time in prison.
It's because they got long sentences. It's because for the last 20 or 30 years, this country has been drunk on the concept of lock them up and throw away the key. Mm-hmm. If you lock them up and throw away the key, they're going to get old. Mm-hmm. And then you're going to have to deal with that.
I'm assuming that, however you're defining it, by age 50 and over 55, that those people have done a long time in prison. Is that right?
Yes, they've done a long time simply because, as Laura alluded to, the zeitgeist in this country is about punishment, perpetual punishment, and never giving up on punishing a person, especially those that were committed for serious crimes. In my own case, I had a sentence of 15 years to life, and you would assume that if I, during that minimum period that was imposed on me, the 15 years, if there were indications that I had rehabilitated myself, shown that I was a changed person, that I would have been released. But that didn't happen. I can go into a lot of details about my accomplishments that I made by the time I reached that 15-year mark. But the point is that those things are not considered. Perpetual punishment is the mode. And I served 18 years above and beyond that 15-year sentence simply because I wanted to exact as much punishment out of me as possible.
Mujahid, what age were you when you went in?
I was 28 years old when I went in.
So and you did 33. That I can't add fast enough, but what's...
I came 61. Out, which is 62, yeah.
Wow.
And he should say, he went to the board 10 times before they let him out. And
it's the parole board that just says, and our, you know how to say no.
They know how to say no very well. And our project is called Release Aging People in Prison. And the reason we say release is because this age group and the people who've done a lot of time, the lowest risk of recidivism lies in this group. Now, let me just flip a little script here. People say there have been a lot of stories in the papers about reducing the prison population. And even Holder said, Eric Holder, when he made his speech and talked about expanding compassionate release in the federal prison system, he said, for people who have nonviolent convictions. When everyone says low risk, that's who you think of, right? People with nonviolent convictions. The lowest risk category is people who are over the age of 50, have done 15 or more years in prison, and committed murder. Yes. And that comes from the New York State Department of Corrections studies, as well as across the country. So what we're saying is that this group of people in prison is ready to be released with no threat to public safety. And if the point of prisons is to protect public safety, then why would people who are in their 50s, 60s, 70s, who've done a lot of time and have a low risk of committing another offense not be released?
It seems intuitive to us on Law and Disorder of the many reasons this is inhumane, but can you just talk about a couple of the reasons that you make the case for why people of a certain age should be released?
Here's one. Let me start off with this one. The sentencing structure that allows this thing to happen that we are talking about is called an indeterminate sentencing structure. That means you're given a minimum and a maximum. Some people get 10 to 20, some people get 5 to 15, and others with the most serious crimes get a number, and on the end they get letters. 15 to life, 25 to life, 20 to life, likewise. But in that indeterminate sentencing structure, there's the implication that a person should be released if they're reformed or rehabilitated at that minimum imposed term. In my case, I received the 15 to life for an attempt murder on a police officer. He didn't get a scratch, but that was the least amount that could be imposed on me, the 15 years to life. I couldn't get any less, although he didn't get a scratch. So a person who's serving a sentence such as that would have an expectation that the 15 years or whatever they have to be released if they changed. And to deny them and not give them a reason for the denial, to simply say the nature of your crime takes away hope from a person, and it causes them quite a bit of distress.
You accomplished some remarkable things while you were in prison. I don't want you to be shy here. Mm-hmm. Tell us what you did.
Yes, I'll do it for the sake of illustrating how serious the problem is. I was arrested in 1978. I went upstate within 6 months. You know, I was bum rushed to trial. Up north, serving my sentence within 6 months. But the point is that before that 6 months came, I had earned my GED. I was arrested without a GED. I did that while facing trial, earned a GED. I went upstate with no expectation of serving 15 years. I actually thought that because of the facts surrounding, you know, the offense that I was convicted for, that I would eventually win on appeal. That didn't happen. But while fighting for my release on in the courts on appeal, I still went on and tried to improve myself. Within a few years, I would say about 5 years, I had earned an associate's degree in business. I went on and got a bachelor's degree in liberal arts a couple of years after that. Shortly after that, I earned a master's degree in sociology. And then I went on and earned another master's degree in ministry. And all of that happened before that 15-year period. In addition, I had been involved in creating a number of rehabilitative programs within the system. I had earned dozens of certificates in different areas, and none of that was considered by the parole board when I appeared at that 15-year mark. They simply denied me and didn't give me any guidance of what I could do to better myself to earn release. In fact, at my fifth board, it occurred to me to ask them that. I said, in the event that I'm denied, could you tell me what I can do to make myself better, you know, qualified for release? And they actually got angry when I asked them that.
The other thing that Fareed did inside that we should mention is that he, along with David Gilbert, who's a political prisoner who is still in prison in New York State, began the first in the nation, the first peer education, counseling, and support program for people inside with HIV/AIDS. And that was done in a period when I was in prison in those years too, and I remember exactly what it was like for people with, we didn't even call it HIV then, that was before we even knew what it was. It was GRID or AIDS. And the hatred and anger and fear of people was so strong that creating that program was a shining light that then got picked up in other places as well. So I just wanted to mention that. Mm-hmm. But you asked about other reasons why this is such an injustice. Let me just tell you about one man that we know whose name is Mr. Coty, and he's in the New York State system. And we are focusing on New York State. That's where we are. Each state has different ways of releasing people. So we want to make a difference. We don't want to just educate about this project. We want to change it. Okay, Mr. Coty is 87 years old. It's pretty old. He's been locked up for 30-something years. He has myasthenia gravis. He has high blood pressure. He has cancer. And he was rushed to the hospital last year with a life-threatening situation due to the cancer. And as a result, the parole board moved his next parole date up to this past May. It was supposed to be in November. They moved it up to May. He goes to the board, and they tell him, no, you can't get out because you might commit another crime. The man is 87 years old and he's in a wheelchair. Now, that's not the only, so we're talking about, you've talked about Lynn Stewart's case, rightly so, on this show, and advocated for her release on compassionate release. She's in the federal system. The feds are very stingy with compassionate release. So is the state of New York. In 2011, I think it was, they let out 8 people on compassionate release in a year when nearly 200 people died just that year in the system.
I understand that the recidivism rate for elderly people is like 1%. I mean, something like almost zero. But what's the cost of keeping an elderly and ill person in prison? What's the cost of keeping anybody in prison?
Well, in New York State, the average cost is around $60,000 because the budget, we calculate that by dividing the number of people that's confined into the budget.
Young and old, 60 grand.
In general, right, in general. Now, people 55 and over cost 2 to 4 times more than it would cost for, you know, the average person. And so when we say 60,000, you can calculate that and see that the costs are astronomical when we talk about how much it impacts on the prison budget.
Part of that is because people, it's been documented by scientists that people who are in prison age at a rate about 10, it's like HIV, age at a rate about 10 years older. So
15,
yeah. I'm now 68, but I feel like 78 on some days. And
you look good, Laura.
But the other thing is that in addition to all the costs, is that every time someone who's incarcerated goes to an outside hospital or a specialist, they have to have security detail with them, and those guys get overtime. And it's costing the taxpayers huge amounts. And not only does that waste money, but in terms of public safety, that money could be used. We're always talking about all the things that could happen in the community if only there were the money that could prevent young kids from being arrested, that could prevent people from going to prison. There's the money.
We're anxious to hear the specifics of the program you're working on.
Well, let me start by saying that nothing needs to change in the law. We don't really need a new law in order to release the people we're talking about. What we need is for the parole board to follow the law. What we need is for the state to follow the law on compassionate release for those who are ill. But what we need is for the parole board to follow the law on release. And the former head of the parole board just said, and it's in the New York Law Journal last week, I think, or this week, said that the way that the parole board comes to a hearing and says to a person in prison, you can't get out because of the nature of the offense, is, and this is his word, not mine, stupid. And so what we're saying is that to say to someone like Mr. Coty, you can't get out because you might commit another crime. To say to someone like Fareed when he went for the 8th or 5th or 3rd time, you can't get out because the nature of your offense means that if we let you out, it would cause disrespect for the law. That is, and I don't know, I'm not the former head of this parole board, so it might not sound good for me to say that that's stupid. Let me just say, I don't think it comports with the needs of public safety or humanity. So one thing that we're doing is we're trying to join with other people in the state who have had enough of the way that the parole board just denies people over and over again, and try to say, use actual risk assessments, which do exist, which the parole board is supposed to use. And then if someone, we have a phrase that Fareed and I came up with based on Johnny Cochran's famous, if it doesn't fit, and ours is, if the risk is low, let them go. That's the strategy is partly that. The other part of it is to educate the public so that people don't assume that low risk means you didn't do very much. Low risk is an assessment of whether you will commit another crime, and there is a scientific way to look at that. So what we're trying to do is let people know that they shouldn't go for the political easy way out. You know, we talk about mass incarceration. This is a period when people, as Fareed said in the beginning, are paying attention, and so some people have been released. The Rockefeller drug laws were reformed. If we don't get to the heart of that issue about who's low risk and who's not, if we allow the politicians and the police to keep saying to us, if someone committed a serious offense, they're dangerous, no matter what has happened since they were 19 years old, like Jalil Muntakim when he committed his crime and he's now, I don't know, 64 or something, then we will never resolve the problem of mass incarceration. We'll just pretty it up around the edges.
We're speaking with Laura Whitehorn, who did 13 years? 14 years. Excuse me.
Now that I'm out, I wanted to count.
Mujahid Farid, who did 33 years. Mm-hmm. What is the name of your project? How can people get in touch with it? What can people do to help?
The name of the project is RAP, which is an acronym for Release Aging People in Prison. We are hosted at the Correctional Association of New York, which is in Harlem. The address is 2090 Adam Clayton Powell Boulevard. We are in Suite 200. That's zip code 10027. And the phone number at the Correctional Association is 212-254-5700. And you can also email me directly at mfarid, that's F-A-R-I-D, mfarid, at correctionalassociation.org.
And let me add something. We have a web presence on something called The Nation Inside, because we want to join with other groups, and we're part of other campaigns to reduce mass incarceration and to attack the nature of the prison system. People can find us at, and this is a little long, nationinside.org/campaign/release-of-aging-people-in-prison. And I'm sure that maybe you could put that on your website so people could find it. But if people will email or call Fareed, they can get that too.
I still can't quite understand what's going on, because it just seems crazy what's going on. I mean, I look at YouTube, but and you talk about the parole board, and it's obviously a disaster on these issues. But really, why? There has to be something more than just a few individuals on the parole board saying, we're not going to let people out who we know will not commit another crime, because we're not going to. There's something else going on. I know you've probably talked about it a bit here already, but
I'm trying to expand on it a little bit. As I said, I refer to it as the zeitgeist of the times. Actually, as Laura said, there's no need for legislation to correct this problem. It got really bad a little more than 20 years ago when Governor George Pataki took office. When he took office, the release rate of people with A1 felons, these are the people we're talking about, A1 felons, took a nosedive from about 30% down to about 7%, and then it went even lower than that. It went close to 1% of the release of people with these type of convictions that we're referring to. And every year that Governor Pataki was in office, doing his State of the State address, he would issue marching orders to all of the people in the criminal justice arena to tighten up more on parole and releasing people convicted of violent offenses. We see the residual of that today. It hasn't been dissipated. We see the residual of that. In fact, it didn't just happen in New York. This was something that happened nationwide. And that's what we're dealing with.
And I think you're right, Michael. It's not a matter of individuals. It's a system. And it's also a political system. And, you know, we say we don't need legislation. If the legislature of New York wanted to pass a law saying that if you're over the age of 50 and you've served a certain number of years in prison and you've meet a risk assessment, that they have to give a very good reason why not to release you, we would applaud. But it has to include everyone. It can't be limited. But the point is that the society gets something off of this. Politicians can say, I'm not soft on crime, I'm locking people up. The number of people in prison goes up and down, and it shows no direct relationship to the number of crimes that are committed. So this is a system-wide problem. This isn't just about older people. Fortunately, across the country, legislators and all kinds of corrections officials have finally noticed that it is a total human rights violation to lock up children. There have been some changes where kids don't get the death penalty and don't get life without parole if they're under a certain age, based on science and brain formation and all those things. This has not extended. It's like you have to find the saddest example. You have to get people's heartstrings going instead of saying what makes sense as a system of justice and of public safety in this country. And the prison system as a whole is a little insane, you got to admit. People getting these huge sentences. You know, when I was first arrested in 1985, I was facing, I can't remember, I think 78 years for political offenses because political prisoners were charged, overcharged in those days. The women and that now. I was, and now, but no, but it's gotten, it's actually, I think it's actually changed. I was in Baltimore City Jail, and the other women that I was with were horrified at what I faced. By the time I actually went to trial, 3 or 4 years later, my prospective sentence was not that out of line with other people's, because there were, you know, the effective death penalty and whatever that law was, the things that happened under Clinton, which shows that it's not only, isn't it, individuals, it's not even one party or the other. It was just easier than stopping the gap between rich and poor, and certainly more palatable for the rich, is to lock up poor people and keep them in prison, and then be able to say I'm for safety.
We really take our hats off to you two and to the Corrections Association that's housing the project and the Soros Foundation that's funding it. And we want you back. We want to be able to report the progress that you make and eventually report the victories that you have.
Mm-hmm. And can I just announce two other things?
Of course.
So first of all, we're having an event at Fordham Law School on Saturday, the 12th of October. It'll be in the evening. And Fareed will be speaking, and Tina Mashey, who's a president of the National Association of Forensic Social Workers and who's part of our project, will be speaking. The first Wednesday of every month, we have a coalition called Release Aging People in Prison. It evolved out of the Drop the Rock Coalition, and it meets at the Correctional Association on the first Wednesday of every month, and we do outreach, and we have pizza, and we plan events, and we've had, I don't know, from 30 choices on a rainy night, maybe 15, other nights 30 people there, and everyone is welcome. We need help. We need to fight this.
Mujahid and Laura, thank you so much for being on, and we really do look forward to having you again.
If the risk is low, let them go.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Great.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
He was born in the summer of his 27th year, coming home to a place he'd never been before. He left yesterday behind him. You might say he was born again. You might say he found the key for every door. When he first came to the mountains, his life was far away, on the road and hanging by a song. But the string's already broken, and he doesn't really care. It keeps changing fast, and it don't last for long. But the Colorado Rocky Mountain I've seen it rain and fire in the sky. The shadow from the starlight is softer than a lullaby. Rocky Mountain High, Colorado.
It was front page news when Attorney General Eric Holder announced that the Department of Justice would reassess the harsh mandatory minimum sentences on nonviolent drug offenders that unfairly target young African Americans and Hispanics. Some drug reform advocates called it a breakthrough. However, our guest, Ethan Nadelman, executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance, says there was no mention of clemency or pardons
for those imprisoned with disproportionately long sentences. Holder did mention that the United States represents about 5% of the world's total population, and yet it incarcerates nearly 25% of the world's prison population, five times the percentage it would be if we were like the rest of the world. Recent reports from the Federal Bureau of Prisons state that 47% of inmates in the U.S. were convicted of drug offenses. African Americans comprise 37% of the prison population, and Hispanics make up 35%, way, way, way beyond their percentage in the U.S. population. Ethan Nadelman joins us to discuss this important issue. Ethan Nadelman, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's a pleasure to be on.
Ethan, we always love having you on to bring us up to date on your work, what's happening with prisons and drugs, legalization, etc. This time, a couple of, really, it looks like, hopefully positive events, although I want to hear what you say. The first that struck me was, of course, the front page news that Eric Holder was giving a speech about the fact we may have too many people convicted of drug offenses in our prisons. And that seemed to be a big deal, even though it's 5 years after he took office. But tell us about what Holder said, what you think it means, and what its pluses and minuses are.
Well, first of all, I'd just say that what he did say was too little, it was too late, and it was still incredibly significant historically and in actually impacting on people's lives. You know, Eric Holder had let people know during the first term that he regarded addressing the issue of mass incarceration as a legacy issue for him, something that he cared about personally, that he wanted to do something about. But all the people around him and Obama were basically saying, second term, this is a second term issue. We'll take care of as much as we can about the way that crack powder and crack cocaine and powder cocaine are dealt with differently. And they did, in fact, make good on that commitment early on in the first term. President Obama and Attorney General Holder, working with Drug Policy Alliance, a whole range of allied groups, did actually change the penalties, the mandatory minimum penalties for crack cocaine. They didn't abolish, get rid of the disparity between how crack cocaine and powder cocaine are handled, but they went as far as they could go. But then they just dropped the ball. They did nothing more for the following years of the first term, and it was immensely frustrating. And when I would raise the issue with people close to the president and attorney general, they would say, look, we care. We get it. Second term if we get it. Right. Well, the nice thing is they got the second term now, and Holder did stand up. You know, this is in August, you know, 7 months after the second inauguration, and say, let's really do something here. And what he did was not just significant in speaking about this issue, not just in fiscal terms and public safety terms, but in moral terms. So the nature, the substance of the speech was important. But the second thing was by saying that he was going to be issuing explicit directives to U.S. attorneys around the country that would affect the way they charge people, especially low-level players in drug trafficking organizations. You know, this whole thing where if you're a courier or a low-level guy answering a door, the girlfriend of a trafficker, and because of our conspiracy laws, you land up getting hit with 10 and 20-year mandatory minimum penalties while the higher-ups who have information to trade don't really go away for that long. I think you were really going to see a measurable impact in terms of federal sentencing for drug offenses. So I got to give Holder credit where credit's due. I'm glad they took it up within the first year of the second term. I think he really does regard this as a legacy issue. You know, President Obama as well, he gave this fascinating interview in Time magazine last December in which he said things like, I realize that our criminal justice policies are destroying the lives of millions of Americans. He said that. And then he said, but I'm not going to provide any leadership on this. I will follow. When the states and others, and this can be done in a bipartisan way, I'll help it along, but don't expect me to lead. But then, you know, a week after Holder's speech, in President Obama's speech commemorating the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's famous speech, he mentioned incarceration in that context. So mentioning the issue of over-incarceration and the need to reduce it in the context of memorializing Martin Luther King, that too was very significant.
You know, it's significant, but, you know, I'm sitting here with Michael, and, you know, I'm a big doubter of Obama's words, having been disappointed from, you know, Guantanamo to drones to everything else. So the question for me is, both with Obama's words, but even more with Holder, is what are our expectations in the next 3 years? What are your expectations, and what do you think they'll actually follow through on? Well, there's millions of people in prison. Is it going to affect them? Is it just going to affect some people going forward? What do you think it does? It tells judges not to sentence him as long? What are their memos going to do? There's mandatory sentences for a lot of this.
Well, I mean, the first thing is this, is that unlike, say, the Guantanamo issue, where you had the Republicans kind of flip on that thing and get in the way of Obama's commitment, and we can castigate him for not acting unilaterally, it was interesting that Holder, in his speech, emphasized the extent to which Republican governors are showing leadership, not just Democratic governors, on sentencing reform. So they're really pushing this through in a bipartisan way. And what was quite striking about Holder's speech was how little negative response there was even from Republicans, even from lock-em-up Republicans. So I think there's more bipartisan support for this sort of thing than we've seen before. I think, secondly, keep in mind, the federal prisons hold roughly 200, 225,000 people. That's about 10% of the overall incarcerated population. They don't directly control the other 90%, right? What's generally happened over the last 20, 30 years, guys, is that we've seen the overall prison population, federal prison population, increased dramatically. We've seen the drug law violators decline from roughly 65% of the total to 48% of the total, even as the absolute numbers have gone up.
So in essentially, the federal prison,
we've gone from 60,000 drug law violators out of 100,000 people incarcerated to maybe something like 110,000 drug law violators out of 230,000 incarcerated. Rough numbers there. So I think we are going to see a reduction in the amount of time that people are being sentenced to in federal prisons. I think we're going to see low-level drug violators being charged in different ways. Because let's remember, one thing about mandatory minimums is what they effectively do is shift the discretion from judges to prosecutors. Mandatory minimums empowers prosecutors at the hands of judges, right? And so I think what we'll see is a downshifting in how much prosecutors are looking for. We'll see fewer people going to federal prison on drug charges and them going there for less amount of time. I'll also tell you this, talking with the woman who heads my California office, she said in the 2 or 3 days after Holder's speech, that in her conversations with state and city officials dealing with, say, implementation of the three strikes reform law and sentencing reform, that she was already feeling a difference in the tenor of the discussions. That there was something about that speech that caused a lot of people who have been sitting on the fence to say, okay, the winds are turning. Now we have to really get serious about reducing incarceration. That we are redefining the problem in America as the problem of crime is now becoming the problem of over-incarceration. That's a slow transition. It's a major shift in thinking, but I think that Holder's speech did have some positive momentum in that regard. Never forgive him, look, for not having done anything that first term except for the crack powder thing, but you got to give him credit here.
Let's go back, though, a little bit to what you're saying. So we're talking about the 250,000 federal prisoners, a little less than half being drugs. Does Holder or anything that you see in the next 3.5 years offer any hope for those people, the 110,000 that are in federal prisons? And then I want to go to state, but let's first work on federal.
I'm not sure about the answer, Michael. Typically what happens, and we've seen this on the legislation as well at both the state and federal level, is that legislators are notoriously resistant to having any sentencing reforms be retroactive. So they're willing to say, going forward, we'll reduce the sentence, but we're not going to touch the issue of the people who are already locked up under the old laws. And the fear, of course, is always the Willie Horton fear, that somehow somebody will get out, will commit some heinous crime, and then, you know, it all gets blamed on them and they lose the re-election. That said, once you change the law prospectively, what happens is the moral inconsistency of treating one group of people differently than a group that's left behind creates an amazing pressure to resolve the people who are still sitting behind bars. So I would bet that we are going to see some movement on the people who are behind bars as well. I don't know. We've been so disappointed in President Obama in terms of the lack of clemencies and pardons he's done. He's been worse than virtually all of his predecessors. But I'm thinking that we're going to see some movement to get some of these people who've been sitting there, nonviolent, you know, drug law offenders sitting there for 10 and 20 years with minimal risk to public safety if they get out. I think we're going to see movement in that area too.
Now, that's the federal, which is about 10% of the drug prisoners.
Of all prisoners. It's a little more than 10% of drug prisoners because statewide, roughly 20% of all inmates are for drugs. In the federal prison, it's 50%.
So tell me, how are you going to deal with the state? I mean, well, how, not you, but how are they going to deal with the state? And you said generally, yeah, the states look are looking to reduce. But is something, is anything really happening in the states? Are they still judges putting away people for long periods?
They can't directly control state laws, right? A lot of that's left up to advocacy organizations like Drug Policy Alliance and a host of others working at the state and national level. It's left up to state legislators and the growing number of governors who are actually showing some leadership on this, sometimes for fiscal reasons, sometimes for moral reasons or what have you. That's where most of the work has to be done. There are small things, however, that the federal government can do. One thing I know we talk about shortly is the shift on marijuana policy. Half of all drug arrests in America are for marijuana and overwhelmingly for marijuana possession of small amounts. Now, that's not what's filling the prisons, but it's sending a lot of people to jail, and it's a sneaky way in which you have over 5 million people under the supervision of parole and probation in the United States. When they get arrested for some petty crime and get given parole and probation, and then they fail a drug test or get caught with a joint, they're getting incarcerated. So you have some significant number of people behind bars simply for a low-level drug possession where they're not being called drug law violators because their initial offense was for something else. So I think that the movement on marijuana is going to help in that area. I think that secondly, you've had this program that used to be called the Byrne Grants, named after a police officer in New York, Byrne, who was murdered by drug dealers 20 years ago. That's given funding to state police agencies, fairly unregulated, that's helped fund these federal state task force that have done all these horrific, you know, you remember the Tulia, Texas scandal some years ago. Mm-hmm. If any of you saw the piece in the New Yorker magazine about these asset forfeiture scandals. So I think that reducing the amount of unrestricted funding going to local law enforcement agencies through these grants programs, that could be a second significant thing.
We're speaking with Ethan Nadelman from the Drug Policy Alliance. Ethan, what about the federal government holding off when states do pass a law that at least decriminalizes and in some cases makes legal possession of marijuana? What's the federal government going to do about those states now?
Well, I mean, that's the really remarkable development. When states change their sentencing laws or when they decriminalize the possession of marijuana, the feds don't really pay much attention to that. But when the states move forward through either the ballot initiative process or the legislative process to legalize marijuana, either for medical purposes, which is what 20 states have now done, or more broadly for all adults, which is what Washington and Colorado have done, that presents a basic issue for the federal government. It's now the states are free to repeal their own marijuana prohibition laws. That does not conflict with federal law. But once a state wants to set up a responsible regulatory regime to tax it, control it, regulate it, which is what the states have been trying to do on medical marijuana and what Washington and Colorado are now trying to do with the broader legalization of marijuana, that's where you run into real potential conflicts with federal law. Now, the challenge for the White House and the Attorney General is that they cannot order local federal prosecutors not to enforce federal law, right? The White House or Justice Department can get in trouble for doing that. What they can do, however, is issue guidelines saying to U.S. attorneys around the country, here are our priorities, here's how we think you should handle this. What the Attorney General did a week and a half ago, and what's known as the Cole Memorandum, named after the Deputy Attorney General James Cole, who testified before Congress yesterday, was to basically say, here's our new guidelines, that we are basically saying to Washington and Colorado, proceed with caution, but you can proceed in trying to implement these new legalization laws. They're saying, here's the criteria by which we're going to evaluate you. You know, are you keeping organized crime out of it? Are you keeping violence out of it? Are you restricting access to young people? Are you avoiding having marijuana being exported from Washington, Colorado to other states? There's a whole set of criteria, which are mostly the sets of criteria that we would recommend are the relevant criteria. And that memorandum that they issued 2 weeks ago, a little less, that is of great historical significance. I mean, they're basically saying, we get it. We get it. That legally regulating marijuana may accomplish the objectives of federal drug control more effectively than continuing with an ineffective prohibitionist policy. That us as federal government, our concerns are to protect public safety and public health. That's our bottom line focus. Those are the first principles of drug control, which we lost sight of during the last decades of the drug war. And now it appears that what the Justice Department is saying is, let's go back to first principles. Federal drug control is about protecting public safety and public health. If Washington and Colorado can accomplish that through a legal regulatory approach to marijuana, rather than continuing the prohibition system, we're willing to give this a go. Mind you, we're still retaining all options. If we see an opportunity, you know, we see there's a reason to interfere or to go after people, we'll do it. But I got to tell you, and I'll tell you this too. When they issued that order 2 weeks ago, I was in Jamaica. Country Jamaica, which is having a discussion about legalizing marijuana, ganja they call it, right? Meeting with top-level people from the opposition party, the governing party. And their first question to me was, this was Wednesday, 2 weeks ago, so what's the U.S. Embassy going to do? I mean, let me tell you, they're telling me stories of how the U.S. Embassy called them up to pressure them, and like, even just for decriminalizing possession. And I was saying to them, listen, it's a different world. You know, Uruguay is moving forward with legalizing marijuana, no evidence of interference, public opinion, Colorado. And they're looking at me skeptically. The very next day, the Justice Department in Washington issued that memorandum, and my credibility shot up dramatically. It's basically, how can the U.S. Embassy in good faith tell Uruguay, Jamaica, or anybody else not to move forward with doing exactly what Washington and Colorado are doing?
So it's Washington and Colorado that are legal so far, and there's a number of states that are medical now.
20 states, including Washington and Colorado, that are medical, but two that are legal. But I'll tell you this, Michael, there's public opinion polls all around the country. Some are private polls that we've done, some are public, but you go from New Jersey and New York to New Mexico to D.C. to Hawaii to Oregon, you name it. We are seeing, I just saw a poll at Louisiana showing a majority of people in favor of legally regulating marijuana like alcohol. So we are seeing a shift in public opinion on the legalization of marijuana that tracks almost identically the shift in public opinion on gay marriage. Just look up Gallup poll, put in gay marriage or marriage equality, and then put Gallup poll, marijuana legalization, and those two polls basically lay over one another with almost no difference.
Well, this is really thrilling news. The camel's nose is under the tent. If not Ethan's, at least the camel's. But I wanted to ask you about, there's this famous television doctor, Gupta.
Yeah.
Who used to be against medical marijuana, and now he's done a 180.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you what that means in terms of legitimization of medical marijuana.
When Dr. Sanjay Gupta, the CNN medical correspondent, did that special on medical marijuana last month, it was remarkable. Never before have I had so many people who don't pay any attention to drug policy say to me, did you see that? Did you see that? I'm talking about it. I mean, everywhere. Now, why was that? First of all, not only was the show itself incredibly significant, in a way I'll explain in a second, what he also did was a few days before the show aired, he wrote a public apologia, right? Basically saying, when I spoke out against medical marijuana 6 years ago, saying the evidence was not in, I was wrong. And I was wrong not because there's new research. I was wrong because I didn't do the job I was supposed to have done back then. And for Sanjay Gupta, the country's leading medical correspondent, the guy who President Obama first nominated to be the Surgeon General, and then it didn't work out, but who nominated, for him to say that brought amazing amount of attention to his show. The other thing that was significant was not only did he show this heartbreaking and compelling story of a three-year-old child for whom marijuana is the only thing that helps to deal with her form of epilepsy, this horrific disease. What he also did was he uses an opportunity to talk more broadly about the risks and benefits of marijuana. He goes to Israel, which has the most developed medical marijuana program in the world. Remarkable, you think, on a right-wing government, but they have a great medical marijuana program. And he interviews a Holocaust survivor talking about how using marijuana in his elderly years has helped him. He goes and he looks at the evidence around marijuana and driving. And I think he went into it assuming, you know, don't smoke and drive, that's that, right? Just like alcohol. But he came out with a more nuanced view, which is to say, if you're an inexperienced user, you should not be driving. But quite frankly, the research shows that if you're an experienced daily marijuana user, using it for medical or other purposes, the research suggests it's hard to distinguish you from somebody who's totally straight. Right. So he said remarkable things around marijuana in that. So that show, I have to say, was in some respects a game changer.
So, Ethan Nadelman, if people want to connect with the Drug Policy Alliance, how do they do that?
Well, go to our website, drugpolicy.org. And the other thing people should know is every 2 years, we organize the leading gathering in the world of people who are against the drug war. So go to the website, reformconference.org. It's going to be in Denver, October 24, 5, and 6. People from around the world, over 1,000 people. Fantastic. I describe it as a hybrid of a graduate-level seminar on drug policy and a three-day revival meeting.
Let me ask you about that. It's in Colorado, a legal state. What does it mean to be legal? Does that mean I can go there and smoke from morning, noon till night all the time?
Well, you
outside?
Could, Michael, truth be told, you could probably do that in New York City as well. but the fact is, you're not allowed to do it outside.
Oh.
Right? Just like you're not increasingly not allowed to smoke cigarettes anywhere, and you're not allowed to drink alcohol in public places. So the marijuana thing is for private consumption.
But you can't smoke indoors, well, at least in New York.
But that's actually the big trick. But people can smoke in their homes. We'll see how the hotels accommodate it in private open spaces. And I think, by and large, the police are not getting all bent out of shape about arresting people who smoke a joint in public. But it's still not legal to do that.
Do you think in a smoking lounge, for example, in the Denver airport, that you can light up a marijuana?
That's a great question.
Well, I think one last thought might be, like, if I only smoke like a few days a week, I shouldn't be driving, but so I should start smoking every day, because I'll get used to it. I'll be a better driver,
it's
right?
It's more about the potency of the marijuana and your experience level, right? I mean, the fact of the matter is, and where you're driving. But there's a lot of studies out there. I'm not suggesting anybody smoke marijuana and drive, but it sure is interesting how the studies, controlled studies, find that a lot of experienced marijuana users drive just as well after they smoke at the same time.
On driving in Colorado, where it's legal, can you smoke in your car while you're driving?
No. No, you can't smoke while you're driving. They still have those prohibitions, but they're really struggling with that because there's no good test, by the way. It's not like alcohol where you have a blood test that's semi-reliable.
Right.
With marijuana, the blood and urine tests don't really show anything, I mean, except that you've consumed at some point. So there's a real problem there. I would just finish with this. I'm saying, look, marijuana is not the only thing we're working on, right? I mean, the longer-term objectives as well, we want to end the criminalization of drug possession. Portugal
really
moved this forward. You know, over a quarter of all drug arrests in this country are for simple possession of small amounts of drugs, sometimes by people who are addicted, sometimes not. But there's no reason they should be going to jail. If they need help, they should be getting help. You know, thirdly, we want to America should no longer be leading the world in incarceration rates. We want to make America average when it comes to incarceration, not to be leading the world. And that's a long way to go. And finally, there's new drugs around. You know, there's all these club drugs. Some of you saw this electronic music festival over the weekend where a couple people died. There's all the issue with opiates. More people died of an overdose last year than died from firearms or from a car accident. So we're at the forefront of trying to find responsible public health ways to deal with these new drug problems rather than resorting to the old knee-jerk lock 'em up punishment way.
Well, thank you very much, Ethan. As usual, an incredible interview. I love having you.
My pleasure.
Thank you for coming on down.
Our theme song, because of Colorado and your presence and your conference there, we're going to be playing Rocky Mountain High.
So long, Ethan.
Sounds good. Thanks a lot, guys. See you next time.
You know, Heidi and Michael, we got such a wonderful response from many, many listeners on the lawyer jokes that we read, that we want to share another treat with you all out there in radio land. Kunstler live at Caroline's. Bill Kunstler was a friend of ours, a founder of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and a magnificent lawyer, but also a wonderful humorist. And in his last public appearance, because he died shortly after, on August 9th of 1995, Kunstler took the stage at Caroline's Comedy Club here in New York City. Wowed the audience. People told him he missed his calling. We want to play you an excerpt from his stand-up routine on the subject of our discussion with Ethan Nadelman. And here's Kunstler talking about marijuana at Caroline's Comedy Club.
But during the trial, every day, they brought to the table envelopes filled with hair. Apparently the Yippies had sent out a circular. And there may be people old enough here who have gotten some of these circulars, though I doubt it. And in the circular it said, send hair for Jerry and for Julius. Now Julius was the judge, Julius Hoffman. He was as bald as a coot, short, looked and sounded like Mr. Magoo. This is a Chicago courtroom, and so on. We don't have singing when Judy Collins was trying to sing in a Chicago courtroom. In any event, and Jerry had been shaved at Santa Rita Prison doing a 40-day stint for some demonstration. So every day the envelopes came in. Address, Jerry Rubin, Abby Hoffman or Judge Hoffman, care of the United States Marshal Service, Federal Building, Chicago, Illinois. And we'd open them. And we had all sorts of kind of questions going on. What part of the body was this from? Male or female? And so on. I opened one of my envelopes one day, and instead of hair, there was a noxious substance, green sort of vegetative material, which my practice knows to recognize as cannabis, or marijuana, to put it in the vernacular, forbidden by 18 U.S.C. 541 D.A.3. So I said to Jerry and Abby, for Christ's sake, we're surrounded by FBI agents, the judge, marshals, clerks, the press is sitting all over the place. What should we do with this grass? They said, throw a copy of the Chicago Tribune over it, and no one will notice. So I did that. And I sweated it out until 5 o'clock. At 5 o'clock, I said, boys, let's get our asses out of this courtroom. Jerry said, what about the grass? I said, what do you mean, what about the grass? Leave it here. Maybe the cleaning people will get it, or the marshals will find it and pin it on someone else. I'll take the envelope so there'll be no fingerprints. They said, bullshit. Make a motion, they said. Get that grass. We're not going to leave good cannabis in the United States courthouse. I said, boy, you're asking me to do a heavy thing. I'm 51 years old. I've never spent a lot of time in day jail for drugs yet. They said, get a motion. Get on your feet. So I got up and I said, Judge Hoffman, courtesy of your marshal service, there's been deposited on our table a supply of cannabis forbidden by 18 U.S.C. 541 D.32. I asked, what should we do with it? The judge peered down at me and said, well, you're a resourceful lawyer, Mr. Kunstler. I'm sure you'll know how to dispose of it. I said, Your Honor, it will be burnt tonight. We beat it out of the courtroom, into the men's room on the 23rd floor, where equitable division was made. We had the only legal grass in the United States. Trial was so filled with those memories.
If you want to hear Law & Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law & Disorder Radio on Facebook.